everybody. My name is Jill Bierenbaum. I am the Vice President for State Advocacy and Public Health at the American Heart Association. It's a position that I've had now for 7 years, but in the last going on 3 years now, I've also served as the Executive Director of an initiative called Voices for Healthy Kids, which is a collaborative effort between the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the American Heart Association, focused in particular on public policy that works to engage, organize, and mobilize people to improve the health of their communities and help all children grow up to achieve a healthy weight. I have no relationships to disclose. My main focus here, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues who are going to go a little bit more detail on the two particular parts of the initiative, are to give you some background and talk about some of the lessons that we've learned in this initiative, again, going into now our third year. But as some background, this is a pretty major investment by both the Foundation and the American Heart Association, obviously recognizing the childhood obesity epidemic and the role that public policy has played in terms of other comparable public health challenges that we've had. It's, again, a major investment, nearly about $50 million over 3 years by our organizations. It's also modeled after the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. So for those of you who may have worked in tobacco control policy, for example, that's really the model that we built this on, and that was also an initiative funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and again, built in a comparable way. Where our work and our team at the American Heart Association is focused across this what we call our public policy continuum, so to give you a sense of what we do and where this lives within the association, we're focused on mostly, well, we certainly do federal policy, but my team is focused on state and community level policy, everything from starting to live, from planning and stakeholder development and defining problems that need solutions in public policy, all the way to legislative campaigns, mostly against state, city council, regulatory campaigns, but also assuring that we're building an effective implementation and evaluation to assure that we are continuing to build the evidence base about effective public policy strategies. These are the major areas that we invest. It'll give you a sense of our approach in terms of Voices for Healthy Kids. We invest early and often in campaign research and development, meaning, and you're going to hear about a lot of our message research work that we've done to date and some of our learnings on how we effectively communicate about the role of policy and the specific policies that we're bringing forward, but there's other forms of research that we do as well, legal research, other forms of research. We second then need to fund campaigns. We work a lot with grantees. I'll go a little bit into who we fund, but we fund both American Heart Association as well as non-American Heart Association grantees to run these campaigns. Again, it may be directed at state legislatures, city councils. We then fund them to actually run their issue advocacy campaigns. And the third thing that we invest in is what we call transferring knowledge. So everything from an annual grantee meeting, regional trainings, virtual trainings, all about building the competencies of advocates to be better advocates, better leaders for these campaigns, and building, hopefully in a sustained way, their ability to be effective in whatever they choose to pursue in terms of issue advocacy work. So I'll move next into some of the lessons that we have learned and some of the changes that we've had within this initiative over time. One of the most important things that we do is actually first identify what our public policy priorities are. One of the lessons learned from tobacco control was to have a pretty short, concise list of things to prioritize. For those of you who worked in that area, you're probably familiar with them. Things like we focused on smoke-free air, we focused on excise taxes, and we focused on cessation coverage and funding for state programs. It was a very short list, and it helped us to be far more effective. So one of our early efforts here was to take what were 1,000 different potential policies and begin to create a shorter and shorter list. Although I will say a lesson learned, it's hard to stay disciplined on that. And I'm going to just quickly go over what our current public policy priorities are within the initiative. And you already see there'll be some in red, which are things we added this year because we just couldn't help ourselves. But some of that ad that we did was actually based on, you may be familiar that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation recently recommitted another $500 million over 10 years in the area of childhood obesity, and actually changed a little bit what their areas of priority are, and they're specifically around what they call, and as Risa Lavizza-Morais talked about in this announcement, what they call their big bets. And here's the five big bets. So these really establish their goals as a foundation, what they want to drive. And our role is to then take those five big bets, think about what are the public policies that are aligned to help them achieve these five big bets, then set what we call policy bottom lines, which I won't go into today, and finally to set annual and long-term policy outcome targets related to that. So this year, as we do every year, we reassess what those policy priorities are. These are the current areas we focus first on: how we change public policy that impacts communities, how we change public policy that impacts schools, and how we impact policy and the role that policy plays in early child care and out of school time settings. So these are the specific priorities that we have within community, and specifically a public policy this year around sugar sweetened beverages in kids' meals and restaurants. Some additional policy levers that we have in the community setting, including adding a priority, and I won't go into any details on these, but would love if anybody want to catch me in the hall to go into more detail, or Carter or Jennifer or Bell or any of our team if you want to talk in more detail about any of these, but specifically around some state-level work that we have planned around menu labeling in restaurants. In schools, we were very pleased, a particular area of focus for the AHA more broadly, and now incorporated under Voices for Healthy Kids will be a big invigoration of some focused targeted policy in the area of physical activity and physical education in schools. And added for the first time, because with the five big bets of the foundation came a focus, their focus in the first 10 years was ages 5 to 17, and now they're really focused all the way from pregnancy up through high school. So we were able to add a focus on early child care and education public policy as well. Another lesson learned has been the importance of stakeholder engagement and partnerships. And we've been very fortunate to be joined on this journey by a number of leading national organizations that also share our focus on the role that public policy plays in ensuring all children can achieve a healthy weight. We've had this group, we've been engaging this group of national partners for the last going on 3 years. For those of you familiar with the stages of coalition building, of forming, storming, norming, and performing, I would say we are now in the norming stage. And my big lesson learned in terms of working with these folks is, first of all, the value that they provide, but also the patience that they provided both with us as well as the patience that we've had with all of them, of really getting through these phases of coalition dynamics and opportunity, and feel now that we're all in a very good place of doing very good work together. In the area of what we call national best practices campaigns, so as I talked about, the importance of it's not only thinking about public policies and running campaigns, advocates take a risk every time they go to the legislature and try to do this work. I'm sure you've all seen examples of public policy changes that didn't work out very well, where people got slaughtered in the media because they weren't ready, perhaps, to be going to the legislature or to a city council. There are lots of examples of that, and those advocates on the ground have to trust us. It's a big lesson learned for me in my 15 years with AHA, is building that trust with advocates becomes extremely important. And you build that trust by helping them to be effective and having them take a chance that what you're asking them to do to fight these really hard fights against really sometimes heavy opposition, that you are arming them as successfully as possible. And I won't go, these are some of the specific components that we build out in every one of our campaigns, but you're probably not surprised to learn this, and you're going to hear more about this from Bell and Carter, is it's really been our focus on message research and how to effectively communicate about our policy areas and the importance of that work, of really being able to have advocates feel that they are more effective with the public, more effective with decision makers and others. And again, I'll leave that to them to give you a little bit more detail. I'm actually going to skip this piece. I'm going to talk next about the strong investments in state and local policy campaigns, because this was something that, you know, in tobacco control, we had what was called the Smokeless States Initiative that gave us considerable resources to fund campaigns in states for a lot of years. And we got really good at running those campaigns on how to effectively use PR firms and communications firms and lobbyists and all the things that go into to running a campaign. We had worked really poor in this area for a long, long time. And believe it or not, we actually weren't very good in the beginning at knowing how to spend money. In fact, one of the first, even before I was able to announce this to our staff in the 50 states that we had this opportunity, I had them in for a training, and we did a session with them called If I Had $1 Million. And it was all about just beginning to think about how to strategically, you know, build a campaign in the first place, and then how to spend these resources wisely to be more effective in terms of our policy work. This is a grid that just shows you how our grants this is on our website for those of you who are interested in learning more, but these are the different grant opportunities. And the biggest, we knew this lesson coming in, but it's played itself out over and over again. The most important thing for you to know about this is this is a mix of two types of broad buckets, you could say. The first is what's over to the left, which is just simply funding somebody to be the person who organizes the work and does the strategic planning. It's just simply a staff person, somebody who can help lead the efforts, coordinate the partners, build the strategic plan, to understand how to do that kind of organizing. What follows after that are broad, more tactical investments. You know, you can hire contract lobbyists, you can have communication support or other support. The other two broad buckets that aren't as evident here that are really important is this is a mix of dollars, and I'm gonna get into this big lesson learned. This is a mix of dollars that are available that were originally Robert Wood Johnson Foundation dollars, and for those of you who don't work regularly in this area, you may not know this, foundation dollars are not available for direct or grassroots lobbying. So we're working in an advocacy campaign with some dollars that can't be used for, from a legal perspective, grassroots or direct lobbying. And so, but American Heart Association and many of our partners who are contributing this as well, our dollars can be. We are nowhere close to the limitations that exist for a nonprofit to be able to lobby. So what's represented in this chart is a mix of dollars available for people, dollars available for tactics, lobbying dollars when lobbying dollars are needed, and non-lobbying dollars when those are appropriate. This is just a snapshot of how we're now currently funding 57 campaigns, and actually this didn't convert well, but that's why, because it has arrows. The big lesson for us within AHA that we have learned big time, and this is the importance of good legal representation. We have a really great lawyer by the name of Alan Madison, and what he helps us to do, I think many of us, and I say this as a lawyer myself, think simply about how you avert risk. That's not how a good lawyer actually thinks in this area. A good lawyer, and this is where we're very fortunate to partner with an organization as sophisticated as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, is you have to think not about just, yeah, of course you want to avert risk, but you also want to think about how you maximize those dollars. These are precious dollars that we have available. And so it's not just we can't do things. We spend most of our days thinking about how we can get to as close to the line and how to deploy resources across lobbying and non-lobbying to be very strategic in terms of making sure we maximize those non-lobbying dollars in the campaign and then bring in those lobbying dollars at that point from in terms of our legal, very good, competent legal staff that would say at this point it's time to spend those lobbying dollars. Another big lesson learned for us is that is just around how, and what I think is one of the most valuable aspects of this initiative has been the ability to connect advocates with one another. Especially when you're on the front lines, when you're working in states and communities, it can feel like a very isolating experience. You know, you might feel like, going to the point, like you sometimes feel like you're the only one. You know, you're in the most conservative state. You must be the only one confronting this. So one of the big things that we've invested in here are things like we have an annual grant team meeting. We do what we call regional advocacy orientations. A lot of ongoing webinars and regional meetings. Some of it's, yes, about training, you know, building their skills, But a lot of this ends up being more affinity, the ability of folks to get together and learn from one another and feel like they're part of a greater movement. And that's been a very powerful aspect of the work. And finally, and Jennifer on our team is going to go into more detail, another really critical learning for us, and this is a slide you'll see also with Jennifer, but I wanted to reinforce it. One of the things that this initiative has done for us, it's really transformed the way we think. Our traditional approach to policy within AHA was a very, very universal policies. So a great example of this is in physical education, where our focus historically was on the number of minutes that kids should have physical education, let's say in the middle school environment, 225 minutes of physical education in middle schools, and we would work to mandate that in states. Very universal policy, that was our approach. What we've really incorporated in this initiative is more of, and you'll hear more about it from Jennifer, is a targeted universalism approach. So it's thinking about how we take those universal policies and assure that we're achieving health equity. And, you know, extrapolating on the physical education example, you know, we've been successful in passing some of those universal policies in the states. There's a southern state where there was an evaluator that came in for 5 minutes. 5 minutes, okay. Evaluator that came in and looked post passage of a state law in the South and looked at the level of implementation that was actually happening. And Carter, do you remember the number? Was it 9%? You know, 9% implementation. And where do you think that implementation was happening? Okay, exactly. Suburbs, places that could already afford to do it. So what we thought was a really great policy. Yay! We thought it was awesome. We celebrated it. We actually exacerbated disparities, right? Because we gave the intervention perhaps to those that needed it least, and we didn't think about those who needed it most and what kind of things we needed to build into our policy approaches from the beginning to assure that we were making sure that this was an intervention that could be applied equitably across that state. And so, again, don't want to take any thunder away from my wonderful colleague Jennifer. I'll let her do that, but this for us has really not only been a lesson learned, it's transformed the work that we do in the approaches that we take in childhood obesity policy, but also the vast other areas of policy work that we do at the American Heart Association. So last thing, I just want to give a pitch for those of you who might be joining us at the Southern Obesity Summit. We're doing two sessions. We're doing a Policy 101 workshop and a Policy 102 workshop, trying to organize our good colleagues in the South, which, by the way, is a particular geographic area of focus for us is in Southern communities, so you can learn more. And we encourage you, if you haven't thought about this summit, it's a great summit, to join. So this is my contact information, and with that, I'm going to turn the podium to Carter and Belle.